welcome to Little Atoms. Little Atoms is a talk show about ideas. Each show features a guest from the world of science, journalism, politics, academia, human rights, or the arts in conversation. If the show has a dominant and recurring theme, then it coalesces around the ideas of the Enlightenment, by which we mean freedom of expression, free inquiry, rationalism, scepticism, the scientific method, secular humanism, and liberal democracy. Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, but always interesting. Our guest this week is Adam Curtis, so I will hand over to Neil Denny to introduce him.
Thanks, Padraig. Adam Curtis is a producer, writer and director of television documentaries such as Pandora's Box, The Mayfair Set, The Century of the Self, The Power of Nightmares and The Trap. Adam's programmes, though always about serious issues, maintain a sense of a tongue-in-cheek humour and are characteristic in their extensive use of archive footage. In his filmmaking, Adam strives to find meaningful connections between historical situations and often focuses on the impact of different ideologies have had on modern society. Adam, thanks for coming on the show.
It's a pleasure.
I've had the pleasure of watching virtually your entire oeuvre this week in preparation for this show. Thanks to the magic that is Google Videos. One of the things that emerges when you do watch your whole body of work is the reoccurrence of certain ideas and themes. There are ideas of how the big ideas in the past have been used toward a society, and often these include ideas of science and progress and how these have been misused, perhaps. Tell us about when you first sort of got interested in this theme.
What I think I'm most interested in is how power works in society, how power is exercised, but in ways that we sometimes don't see it, especially in institutions that appear not to have anything to do with politics and power as we traditionally know it. That's what I'm really interested in. I mean, I think much of our journalism today focuses far too exclusively on the idea that power simply comes through politics as it's traditionally defined in places like Westminster. And I've always been fascinated in looking at how institutions such as scientific institutions, areas like consumerism, have, and even the way we think and feel about ourselves, have power flowing through it, and trying to look at where that comes from. I've grown up, and I've been making programmes, about an age where you have moved from, I suppose, an idea of progress as given to you by large institutions to the idea of progress as the individual fulfilling themselves. And that was the big shift, and I've been trying, I suppose, to trace the way power has shifted from being caught, sort of given to us through the institutions, through the way it's come through us, or we feel it, without really quite realising it. I think that's what my films are about.
Oh, and you can see that journey right across, as I said, right across the body of work, and the Trap, the last series that was broadcast, basically brings us to the position where people now have this idea of individuality, but...
Well, I think it's sort of got stuck.
Yeah, that's the thing I'm sort of looking for. We're at that position where there is just sort of banality and there's
It's more than banal. What's happened is that you had an idea, which in a way was quite a heroic idea, that each individual could be themselves, could express themselves and become better people. In fact, what I was trying to trace in The Trap was that what happened in that process is that you shifted the idea of risk away from institutions and onto the person themselves. And in that process, what people began to do is, far from expressing themselves, began to monitor themselves to see whether they are the correct definition of the individual, whether it's in psychology or in the way they eat, in what they listen to, how they feel and how they behave. And they begin to search for ways of, and are given, ways of monitoring that as individuals. And that, paradoxically, leads them to trying to become like what they think is the right individual, which actually leads to homogeneity. And I was tracing in that series, I think, was how that idea of total expressiveness, being yourself, paradoxically in many ways, has led to a growing homogeneity and to a sense of sort of stasis in society. It may be breaking up now as we enter an economic crisis and politicians discover that they have power, institutions have power, and that's the way to shape the world. The idea of the self may change, but I don't know. I mean, I feel... It's too early to tell.
So does, just clarifying that in my own head, does, in your view, individualism and the fetishization of individualism mean that ideas, big ideas, suffer to an extent, that there's no drive for big ideas when everything is about the single personal entity?
Yes, I mean, I think we are... I mean, it's a very complicated relationship, but I think it's a commonplace to say that we now live in a world where there are no ideas that can inspire people and take them other to another place than where they are, because mm-hmm. where they are is what they are supposed to be in the world of the what's hyper-individualism, mm-hmm. which is where we are. That's it. I think there are other factors. I mean, I think we are deeply distrustful of big ideas because the experience of the last 100 years is to tell us that big ideas often lead to disastrous consequences. So we're also suspicious of it. But I do think there is a relationship between the idea of where do you want to go to today, that it's up to you to choose it rather than to be told it by broadcasters and other elites, because elites are bad. That tends to trap you into your own definition of where you want to go today. Well, if you're on your own, it's quite difficult to work out a utopian vision where you can to which the whole of society can go to. So you tend to become trapped in that, and you start to look around for other people's definitions of where do you want to go to mm-hmm. today, and you get this sense of homogeneity, but you also get this sense of stasis, because everyone begins to look at each other. I mean, in the trap, I looked at the origins of the checklists for psychological disorders, like behavioural obsessive-compulsive disorder, all those ones. The psychologists and the doctors I talked to who developed them and used them were quite open in saying, well, actually, once we put them forward to people, people rushed to classify themselves because they wanted to know whether they were normal or not. Mm-hmm. Because in an age of individualism, there aren't the institutions who are going to give you a sense of whether you're normal or not. So people rushed for these things, began to tick, oh, yes, I am. No, I'm not. Yes, I am. And having found out whether they were disordered or not, tried to behave or medicate themselves back to the mean, to the normal. Well, paradoxically, that leads to, again, homogeneity. So the idea of individualism leads to homogeneity and stasis in this particular idea of individualism. But it may be cracking. Mm. I don't know.
This is something we've talked about a few times quite recently on the show, the idea of the medicalisation of everyday complaints and how this sort of has benefited the you know, big pharma and that. And well, I suppose what's interesting here is this very idea that there's, you know, the idea of not what is normal is just such a loose concept anyway. There is no, there isn't a normal. So the very idea that they were, people could go along and see from one of these checklists and be able to be given a concrete idea of what normal should be, I suppose, is quite an interesting new thing.
Well, it is deeply ironic that in an age in which is supposed to be full of wild, expressive individualism, that we seek an agreed definition of normality. But that's the process that those checklists have led to.
Hmm. One thing that I've kind of parroted in my own work quite a bit recently is the idea of, I mean, when you mentioned the word you want to go today idea, which is it's typified, I suppose, by use of the internet and how people use the internet. One thing I've always kind of been working with thought is that what we're looking at with the internet is because there is so much information out there, that the editorial role has shifted from the editor in some sense, from the news organisations in some senses, to the user. The user has to decide themselves what they think is worthwhile and what they think isn't worthwhile. And the news organisations and the bigger institutions seem to be quite keen on this. Why is this?
Well, you're right. The news organisations, including my own organisation, the BBC, have embraced the internet. I mean, sometimes for very, very good reasons, but they have embraced it for other, sometimes I think slightly suspicious reasons. And you're right. It is this idea, which is one of the utopian dreams of the internet, that it is a way of getting rid of the old elites telling you what you should listen to, what you should read, scheduling it for you, finding out stuff and telling you you should know it. Instead, you are offered a cornucopia of stuff and you create, through the new ways of linking information, your version of where do you want to listen, what do you want to listen to today, mm-hmm. what do you want to watch today. It's a utopian idea of democracy, which the media has embraced. I think actually what it's led to, although this is dying away now, user-generated content, which is where you, the user, tell us what is good or what you want to watch, it leads to absurdity. I mean, it actually leads to people who've already seen something giving it to us so we can show it to them Mm-hmm. I mean, okay, there is an argument that then their friends and people who are like them that they don't know can also see them and they would like it. But there is a dark and rather sardonic side of myself which thinks, because I do work in a broadcasting organisation and I know a lot of broadcasters, most journalists have run out of knowing what's going on in the world, mm-hmm. including myself. None of us really know what's going on. And as this crisis that we're going through at the moment accelerates, it is clear that no one knows. Mm-hmm. No one knows why oil was 160 and is now down to $50 a barrel. And they have embraced this idea of media democracy, of user-generated content, as a way, sort of smokescreen, to disguise that fact. It's like, well, we don't know. You tell us. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. I'm deeply suspicious of it. I think it's fading away because, quite frankly, what people sent in to us, and that is not rude to the viewers or to the listeners, was stonkingly banal. Because the whole reason why journalism was invented in the first place is that we have the time and the money and the power of an organisation to go places, find things out, use the power and influence of the organisation to actually push through doors, find things out, bring it back and tell you it and allow you to make up your mind about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what I try and do in my films. I put things out there. You may not agree with it, but it's there to be discussed. That's what a good broadcasting organisation should do. And I mean, you can't really blame the journalists. No one does know what's going on at the mm-hmm. moment, but I am just suspicious of the internet in that way. I mean, I think there is a lot of questions about the utopianism of the internet at the moment, which I think, again, this crisis may begin to crack open.
Yeah. I think there's also, I mean, a problem with the internet in that it's oddly difficult to measure success on the internet. And the way people measure success in the moment is on hit rates. So stuff that gets read, no matter how good or bad, I mean, it's normally either very quite banal stuff or, you know, stupidly controversial stuff gets circulated and read most often. I think we haven't found a way to formulate what's a good internet thing and what's a bad internet thing.
No, I actually don't have a problem with that. I mean, I think one of the good things about the internet is that it is chaotic. Mm-hmm. And I think actually in an age where people don't know those in power don't know what's going on, you just go in there and it becomes this mass, this soup of information and rumour. And in a funny sort of way, that's more real in its fragmentedness. It's sort of like, it's the impressionism of our time. You know, when the impressionists came along, they said, look, people are now, in a way, you had a rise of individualism back then in the 19th century, and they were trying to actually put down on canvas, and in words, what it felt like to actually experience the world rather than to be told it by great stories of statesmen. And in a way, the internet is a bit like that. It gives you an impressionistic, fragmented phantasmagoria, which is a bit like the way we live our daily lives. The trouble is with that is that that phantasmagoria is fantastic. It is like a sort of dream. We do live our lives in a dream. We don't look at the world like a realist painting. But it's limiting. Mm-hmm. It is what it is. It's just a series of fragmented images, which we then go home and make stories out of, and those who write stories, do journalism, make films, take that stuff and make stories out of it. And no one's doing those stories at the moment. So the internet is a great interim, chaotic, almost sort of super real version of what the world is like today. And I think probably if we can archive it, people will go back and look at it, much as we do impressionist paintings. But what's waiting is a new way of pulling all that stuff together, which makes sense and makes people look at the world in a different way and can take them forward. And I don't know whether that's going to happen or whether it's not, but, you know, you should dive into the chaos and love it for what it is at the moment.
The way you've just described the internet there sounds actually like a description of your own filmmaking.
You mean I'm narcissistically projecting myself to the world of the internet?
Well, apart from that, just the idea that, you know, you use this sort of fast-cutting juxtaposition of images to create a narrative that has more in common with dreams than where, you know, the way you use the found footage that you do. Perhaps we should. My question is, let's talk about, you know, how did you develop that way of filmmaking? Why, you know, because it's extremely distinct.
Well, I mean, The sort of honest answer is often out of complete desperation, because I just had this idea when I started, actually when I started doing that series you mentioned called Pandora's Box, is I wanted to do a series of films about how science had been used. Not about science, but about how ideas from science have been taken up by powerful elites and used to try and shape the world and the consequences that flowed from that. The trouble is with that is there wasn't very much to illustrate it with literally. And I got to the point with that series where in cutting rooms late at night, I literally was in tears because I couldn't do it. It was so boring. And I got to, I was making a film about monetarism because I thought monetarism could be looked, which Mrs. Thatcher brought in the 80s, could be looked at as a scientific idea, which was then misappropriated. And I, you know, it's the most abstract idea. Economics is extremely dull. I mean, I know it's not to economists, but it is dull. You know, you float away and you can't, you think you've got it, then you haven't got it. So I just started making jokes out of bits of movie footage. I found that there was a film, an old movie called The League of Gentlemen from the 50s, which I could accurately and rather humorously cut against one of Mrs. Thatcher's ministers called Keith Joseph, who I'd interviewed. And it was sort of like cruel, but it was affectionately cruel, and it was funny, and it sort of brought it alive, and it was out of desperation. And out of that, I began to realise what you could do is pull ideas together by that collage technique. It also is a way of signalling to people that I am, this is my essay. This isn't the news at 10. This isn't the old elites telling you this isn't civilization. This is me pulling together things and saying, have you thought of looking at it this way? And in a way, you're sort of showing the structure by saying, look, you can join this, you can join this. The facts are true, but I'm then arguing something on the top of that, which is it makes you look at the world this way. So it signals that. I mean, that's a slightly pretentious view of it, actually. It's often born out of desperation.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, the filmmaker Jonathan Meads was on the show, and he's been on a number of times. And although on the surface your film's obviously quite different, he has this thing where he uses humour. It's a serious subject, and he uses sort of quite knockabout humour. And he talks about how this idea that people mistake serious and solemnity, and they mistake the idea that you can't be serious and funny at the same time. And I wonder what you think of that yourself.
Well, I think that's a ridiculous position. I mean, I'm a great admirer of him. I think he's really good. Because he does just that. And I think a lot of our journalism, here and in America even more, suffers from such dead seriousness, which actually makes it really boring. You often wonder why they make economics so boring. Because you have these really, really important ideas which do shape the world. I mean, I know there are other forces that shape the world, but ideas are very important. And you sometimes feel they don't really want to explain it, and they make it boring. No, he's quite right. Humour is very funny. And also, it's often very useful in having a go at those in power and actually pulling the poison of fear about big institutions. It's a very, very useful thing as well.
I want to go back to when we were talking about the sort of chaos of the internet and what Padraig raised with this idea about there not being an editor. And well, I'll start this off by saying I found it rather quite a surprising quote on an interview you did with The Register, which said that BBC executives are often surprised that your films are popular with younger viewers. And I think that sort of feeds into this idea that the people that run TV companies don't think that young people can engage with difficult ideas and, you know, are not interested in the big ideas. But it also ties into the fact when I've gone onto the web researching you, your stuff seems to be very popular at the same time with young people that are very interested in conspiracy theories and that sort of thing. And we've often talked on the show about how that sort of mindset comes out of the chaos of the internet and about how the internet has caused conspiracy theories to sort of spread. And the reason I've raised this is that because you have quite, you know, a robust attitude to the idea of conspiracy theories, which chimes quite a lot with mine. So I'd like to talk about that. You're much more of a subscriber to the cock-up theory or the laws of unintended consequences rather than the idea of conspiracy theories. Would that be right?
I think most conspiracy theories tend not to be right because they are simplifications. I think what's interesting, though, is to look at the history of conspiracy theories, recent conspiracy theories. They really emerged in their big form. I mean, obviously Kennedy is important, but all their X-Files stuff comes up from the early 90s when you got the collapse of the last big ideas to be pushed, the big narratives of history. And in their, in the absence of them, came conspiracy theories, or what would be called alternative narratives of history. And really, that's what took over in this age of individualism. Now, in many ways, they're entertaining ways of having a go at those in power. You can see why people do them. And of course, then the events of September the 11th seem sort of just accelerated that, and then the internet accelerated it. I mean, I think, to be honest, they are a consequence of the failure of having any sense of big stories. They are a consequence of hyper-individualism. They are a consequence of the internet. They're just there. What I think is most interesting about the conspiracy theory in its most recent manifestation is something that people haven't really noticed, is that the elites in society, who are on the retreat at the moment because they really don't know what's going on and they haven't got another story, have actually seized on the word conspiracy theory and have mutated it so that they can actually take it and put it as a label on anyone who just questions their power. And whilst I agree with you, I think most conspiracy theories, practically all of them that I've ever looked into, are complete rubbish, fantasies and simplistic infantilism of a sort of narcissistic age. What I think is really interesting is the way those in power, in their classic way, have grabbed that thing and are now using it to their own advantage, because they're basically saying, if they say you're a conspiracy theorist, they're saying you're a nutbag, don't listen to the person. And they're using it quite ruthlessly. I've noticed it.
Drawing back again to the internet, because I just know it's something you wanted to mention, and we've got a couple of minutes. There is chaos on the internet, but the one element that does seem to know what's going on is the people who own it. To an extent, just
well,
the,
I think, I think that's one of the great paradoxes of our time, which I'm actually working on at the moment, is that those who are the promoters of the internet, the boosters, the people who put forward the utopian dream of the internet, and those who basically run Silicon Valley, are arch individualists. They portray the internet as a sort of playground in which every individual can just take this cornucopia of stuff and invent their own identity, do whatever they want with it, and it's a new form of democracy without hierarchies of power. If you actually go and examine what their machines do, especially in their marketing, they use this, I haven't quite worked it out yet, it comes from this thing called Bayesian logic. But their machines can read your behaviour not as an expressive individual. It doesn't care about your emotions. It looks at your behaviour online, your clicks, and then through mathematical processes, it correlates them and makes what they call inferals. They infer things and build up a profile of what you are likely to do. Mm-hmm. That the thing you're probably aware of on Amazon, of if you like this, then you'll like that, comes from this. They say that people actually, if you go and talk to these marketeers, they're completely open about it. They say people are very, very, very predictable. Mm-hmm. They fall it. We can look at everyone's behaviour objectively, almost like old market researchers used to do before focus groups and psychographics came along, and say, from these behaviours and these correlations, we can predict exactly what this person can do.
Yeah,
and it's they're getting very sophisticated. Gmail, which is a very fashionable email amongst quite a lot of web buddies, it actually reads your phrases.
Mm-hmm.
And can make correlations and infer things and your behaviour. It's a fascinating thing because it's a completely contradictory view of what human beings are, how they behave, to what these boosters actually portray the internet as. And it is yet another of these paradoxes. I noticed from my research that the Obama campaign used it. It's called micro-targeting or behavioural targeting. They used it in their campaigns, brought in by Karl Rove in 2004 in the Bush election, and now used in the Obama election. It pays no attention to focus groups. It doesn't ask people what they think, what they want. It looks at their behaviour, who they connect with, who they correlate with, and what they say to each other online. Mm-hmm. And from that works out particular policies that you will like. It's treating you in a way, I think, almost like a behaviourist would do, a B.F. Skinner, as just you're a black box. You do this, then they do that. And but what's even more astonishing is how simplified the categories are.
Yeah.
You're very predictable, which raises rather interesting questions. To what extent is individualism a myth of this age of financial credit? Mm-hmm. Possibly. I've no idea, but it tickles in the back of my brain.
Well, it's bringing us back to the homogeneity idea again, isn't it?
I am rather interested in... What I'm really interested in is whether what we see as wild individualism is actually what was staring at us in the face is complete homogeneity, that we may actually be living in one of the most homogeneous ages, whilst we think that it's an age of wild self-expression. And I mean, it's too early to tell, but I sometimes wonder that whether in 50 years' time people will look back at us in the way we look at those photographs of people in bars in the 1930s where they're all wearing the same hats and the same suits. And we see it as like we're little expressive creatures who are all different. Maybe they'll look back at us and think we're not. Because actually, wherever you start to look at it, like with the psychological categories, everyone is seeking to be like everyone else whilst at the same time pretending to be wild individuals. I mean, I'm just as bad as everyone else, but I just wonder.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point to end on, a good thought to chew over. Adam, thanks very much for being on the show.
Pleasure.